Carolina Roller Girls. Send your questions in right now to electrocution at carolinarollergirls.com. That's ELEKTRAQTION at carolinarollergirls.com. And now, get ready for electrocution, only on WDRBY, Roller Derby Radio.
Hello, hello. You're back with Q's Tips. This is electrocution of the Carolina Roller Girls. You are going to be spending a Wednesday night with me, and this is a really exciting one. If you're new to listening in, I have a really exciting guest that I'm super excited about. If you have questions and you want to talk to me live through email, live is live in email, my email is electrocution@carolinarollergirls.com, or you can hit me up on Facebook under Renee Q McHugh, because Facebook stole my name and they won't give it back. So tonight's guest, and I'm super excited because we don't get to talk about the nitty-gritty of roller derby injuries as much as I'd like to, because I am not a medical provider. I do not understand the human body other than what I can make it do. And tonight's guest is from the Derby Injury Prevention Network. His name is Ryan Lowry. Ryan, would you like to say hi?
Hey, everybody. How's it going? Glad to be here.
I'm super excited about this, guys. I don't know if the rest of you are, but I think it's fantastic that there is an absolute group of people that are working with the Derby Injury Prevention Network to start talking about our specific injuries in this sport. So what made you start this?
Yeah, so I have this mind that I wouldn't wish on anybody because I get all sorts of different ideas that just seem to come to me. So about 3 years ago or so, I was working as a part of my full-time job with the Milwaukee Roller Girls. Shout out to the Milwaukee Roller Girls. Love the Brew City Bruisers. They're a great group. And in my work there, I did some coverage of like the Brew City Brouhaha. I think Champs was in 2013 in Milwaukee. A few different events where people from all over the world came to have their injuries looked at when they came to see us. And so inevitably, as a part of our discussion, I always start asking, well, do you have somebody that you can follow up with at home? You know, somebody has an ACL tear or a, you know, shoulder injury, whatever the case may be, because I always like to leave them with some sort of instructions to follow up with somebody at home.
Right.
And over and over and over again, the answer was no, we don't have anybody. We don't have we don't have a medic. We don't have an athletic trainer. We don't have a team physician. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't believe it. I literally could not believe that. I estimated about 80% of the girls that I talked to, mostly girls, there were some guys, but mostly girls, 80% of the people said, no, that we don't have anybody. And to me, that was just absolutely unacceptable. It's like, we've got a sport that's essentially full contact tackle football on skates, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have anybody taking care of their injuries. Now, that being said, that's not that uncommon throughout the youth sporting world and things like that. But in a sport like this, I couldn't believe it. And so come to find out in further discussions with other people, the real number is actually closer to 95%.
Yeah, I was going to say Carolina, definitely. We used to have a PT guy that would just kind of show up and it was really great. Okay. But we haven't had that since probably 2011.
Okay. Okay.
You know?
Yeah. So I got started thinking, and I started working real closely with Ro. She worked with Windy City Rollers and Papa Doc, and we had, you know, kind of helped each other out with different services and things and different tournaments. And so we just kind of put our heads together, and I say, hey, you guys, what would you think of just starting an organization that's dedicated to injury prevention and roller derby? We can make it a collaborative effort. We can invite people from all over the world to get good information out there and sort of become this network of people to be a resource for the derby community. And they thought it was a great idea. So we officially made it happen January 1 of 2015. And so that's kind of where we started. And, you know, at this point, we've just been trying to put good information out there, evidence-based information about injuries specific to roller derby. So nobody else was doing it. And so I saw literally a global problem, and I wanted to do something about it. So that's how we got started.
Yeah, well, I think it's great. And I just stumbled across you guys because I saw someone had posted your videos from your YouTube channel about roller derby concussion and how we can get concussions or how to prevent concussions and how our sport specifically can cause concussions. And I was just like, wow, I have to talk to these people. So I am super glad that you guys are out there to do this kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, thanks. We're very, very happy to be of service to the derby community. It's really exciting for us. So,
Do you have, do you want to pimp your website right now? I would like to pimp it a few times during the show.
Sure, sure. Don't laugh at us, okay? We're just getting started, but our website is http://derbyipn.webs.com. So that's derby, I as in injury, P as in prevention, N as in network, .webs.com. And that's just, it just has some very basic information, a couple of blog posts. Most of our work that we do right now is on Facebook and on YouTube. So we'd be glad if you subscribe to our YouTube channel, like us on Facebook. That is our major source of information at this point. So we've got some ideas for different things on the website in the works, but you know, for now, that's our main outlet. So
right. So we'll talk about the Facebook page later on too. So we have a ton of people that have questions about roller derby and injuries, and I, you know, we're going to try to get through all of them, but there are quite a few here. So let's start first with Stacy Chikora. Should you replace your helmet every XX months/years, regardless of a head impact? Do those bangs and bumps in your gear bag affect the integrity of a helmet?
Yeah, Stacy, great question. Thanks so much for reaching out to us. So in roller derby, there seems to be this sort of belief surrounding helmets that almost like they have a limitation on how many hits they can hit, they can take, almost like they have sort of a finite number of hits that they can take. You know what I mean? And once you reach that number, boom, it's done. So the truth about helmets is, as long as it fits well, as long as it's in good condition and there's no visible defects, it's not cracked, it's not, I mean, scrapes are fine. You're going to get scrapes and scuffs and things like that. But as long as the helmet is in good working conditions and you're abiding by the manufacturer's recommendations, you really shouldn't have anything to worry about. Now, is it certainly reasonable to replace it every 3 to 5 years? Sure. But my guess is that in most cases, it's either going to be because it's not fitting well anymore, because, you know, the foam on the inside kind of gets compressed a little bit, or, you know, something happens where it gets cracked. For the second question, do the bangs and bumps in your gear bag affect the integrity of the helmet? You know, I would say if it does, it's probably minuscule. The helmets are made to be pretty tough. Their whole purpose is to protect the skull. And so in doing that, you have to have a tough piece of plastic. So, you know, what I would recommend for a helmet is anything that has a good dense foam on the inside and a good hard plastic shell on the outside, and it has to fit well as well. So,
well, can I ask you a question? Because I know that for a while, and I used to rail against these helmets. You have the sure. What used to be the sweat saver helmets from Triple Eight, and okay. they aren't really classified as a helmet, correct? They're classified as a hard hat.
You know, that's a great question. I have not seen that product. Can you describe it to me a little bit?
I don't think they make it anymore, but it was it definitely had the hard shell, but it had a very soft foam on the inside. It wasn't even like a foam. It was like almost like terry cloth and something absorbent, you know, that it would absorb the sweat from your head, but it didn't protect your head.
Yeah. Yeah. So what you want is you want the same type of foam that you see in like a cycling helmet. Okay. It's like a hard, dense foam. And then what you'll have on the inside usually is just a couple of like small cushions throughout the inside of the shell that kind of help with comfort and things like that. But like I said, as long as the helmet is fitting well and there's no visible defects, you know, you should be okay. Now, obviously you don't want a helmet from like the 1970s. Okay. But you know, make
no,
sure you
so what, you shouldn't buy a secondhand helmet.
You know, I personally wouldn't because you never know what that helmet's been through.
Right.
That, and you know, if there is any warranty on the manufacturer side, you might run into an issue if you ever had any issue with that helmet. Mm-hmm. So I would buy new 100%. I would read your manufacturer's instructions very carefully. They know their product. They design their product with a specific purpose. And if there's a shelf life on it, they're going to tell you. And I would abide by that. So.
And the other thing that I think is interesting is, so you said, you know, bumps and bruises in your gear bag, like somebody throws it in their car or something. But I've seen girls lose their temper and wang their helmet on the ground.
Yeah.
And I say that is a replacement. Like? Yeah, that's one that you need to replace at this point. Because if it bounces, it's probably done.
You know, I mean, again, as long as there's no, if you crack it, I would say yes. But I mean, here's the truth. I mean, if you're buying a helmet, they're supposed to be designed to be tough. And what good is a helmet if you throw it, quote unquote, hard enough, and then now you have to throw it away? It's almost like you're just putting a piece of paper on your head. So the first time you use it, then you have to throw it away. So, you know, the one thing that I would caution you with there is that there's no objective way to measure how hard is hard enough. You know what I'm saying? So there's this kind of like misunderstanding out there. It's like, and actually I think there's another question. That's actually Rhonda's question, where she talks about, you know, once I get a good whack to the head, do I have to replace my helmet? No, not necessarily. And you know, then that brings into the conversation the idea of multi-impact helmets. And to be honest with you, I wonder if that's a marketing scheme. I don't really know where that originated from. But if a helmet is worth anything, it's going to be able to survive multiple impacts, okay? So, again, does it fit well? Does it have any visible defects or cracks? And if the answers to that line up with good safety, then you're good to go in most cases. So, you know, it never hurts to replace your helmet, but if I'm going to pay $120 for a helmet or whatever they cost, I want it to do a good job for my skull, you know?
Yep.
So.
All right. Next question is from Rhonda. She actually has two, but her first question is, Rhonda McIntosh, I've heard that you should get a new helmet after a good whack to the head, in which you answered. If the helmet seems okay, is this true? What compromises aren't visible when you inspect a helmet? Aren't helmets designed to take a beating now?
Yeah, I would say yes. Helmets should be designed to take a beating. But what I want to do is let's kind of take a step back, because this is a really, really important portion of the helmet discussion, okay? So I'm a simple guy. I like simple analogies and simple things. So this is a bit of a rough analogy, but I want you to think about your head and your brain kind of like an egg, okay? An egg. If you take an egg and you drop it on a hard floor, what's going to happen to the egg?
Crack,
yeah,
splat.
It'll crack, it'll break, the yolk inside will probably, you know, break open and go everywhere, right? So that's kind of how things work with a head injury directly to the ground or a hard surface, right? If you're not wearing a helmet, you might get a skull fracture. If it's hard enough, you may have some, you know, gray matter spray out on the ground or something like
Gross.
That, right? Yeah, right? Okay, so... So when you wear a helmet, now let's take that egg. Imagine like the shell is your skull, and imagine like the yolk is your brain, okay? Now, if you take that egg and you wrap it up in, say, bubble wrap and maybe a blanket or something that's going to protect that egg, i.e. a helmet, okay, and you drop it on the floor, and the shell does not crack or break. That's perfect. That's it. The blanket and the bubble wrap did exactly what you wanted it to do. But my question then is, does it stop the yolk from moving around inside the eggshell?
Absolutely not.
And it does not, right. So in the same way, the laws of physics still apply to the brain inside the skull. So I'm going to drop a bomb here, and half the people out there will probably say, yes and amen, brother, and the rest will be like, what? What just happened? Helmets are not designed to protect against concussions. We do not currently have specific scientific evidence to suggest that helmets do anything to prevent concussions. Okay, I'm going to say that one more time. Helmets are designed for skull protection, not brain protection. Okay, and the reason is because concussions happen when the brain sloshes around inside the body of the skull. Okay, that's where the brain gets injured. So there, some of these sort of misnomers and misunderstandings of what a helmet can do, we just need to clear that up right away. A helmet was designed for a specific purpose, and that's to protect the skull. So if it's protecting the skull, it's doing its job, and we need to respect the helmet for what it can do, but also what it cannot do. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. I've been saying that for years. The big problem is, you know, they said to actually have a helmet that may protect your head from concussion, I mean, your brain from concussion, it would have to be humongous.
Like, oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, you literally, it would make sporting events impossible. It
right.
It would make collision sports impossible. You basically have to run around with a big bubble on your head.
Exactly.
So no forces would go to your brain, which is just, you know, why even play a sport at that point, right?
Absolutely. So. And that's what I always try to caution people. You know, I say that no helmet is going to stop concussions, you know, not necessarily.
Right. No, it will reduce forces to the brain, okay? So it can, okay? But the problem is it's virtually impossible. Well, not impossible, but it's very, very difficult to translate force reduction to concussion prevention. Okay, that takes a lot of study, and it takes a lot of control, and we're just not there yet. So is it slightly plausible? Yeah, maybe. But in the meantime, if we had a helmet that prevented concussions, we wouldn't have concussions anymore, right?
Right.
So I got off on a little bit of a tangent here, but that being said, if you're looking for a multi-impact helmet, for example, thinking, this is going to protect my brain, it's going to reduce the incidence of concussion, it's going to do this, it's going to do that, you're barking up the wrong tree. Skull protection, yes. Concussion prevention, no. And there are things that you can do to prevent concussions, and we can talk about those as well if you want. But that's a big concept that will actually answer a lot of questions for you. If you stop barking up that tree, then you start looking for another tree.
Well, I have a question to piggyback on that one. So sure. Because helmets don't necessarily protect your brain from concussion, do mouth guards?
No. I mean, there were two studies done, I want to say between 30 and 40 years ago,
mm-hmm.
Where they used cadavers and, tested different mouth guards and forced production to the brain, with different hits to the jaw and to the head and things like that,
mm-hmm.
that showed a reduction in forces to the brain. But again, that evidence is speculative at best. That's consistent with the literature. Mouth guards are along the same vein. Dental protection, absolutely. You want to have a good mouth guard. I recommend a custom fit mouth guard. I actually just released a YouTube video on my review of what I think would be an appropriate mouth guard for roller derby. It's a Gladiator mouth guard.
Mm-hmm.
Take a look on our YouTube channel and that walks you through that. But custom fit mouth guards in general do a better job of dental protection than boil and bite in mm-hmm. general. But they do not protect, as far as we know, against concussions. Now, if the data changes and somebody comes out with two or three or four significant studies that say, hey, this helmet prevents concussion, or hey, this mouth guard does, then we'll change our belief. But my sort of first response is skepticism and mm-hmm. show me the data, and then I'll believe it.
Well, exactly. And I've always been funny about that, because you have to wear a mouth guard, that's part of the rules, but we've had skaters that haven't had teeth. And
yep.
they have to wear a mouth guard anyway, which I think is interesting. But the reason...
no teeth at all?
Yeah, no teeth on the upper or lower. They had full plates, right?
Okay.
They had injury or something wrong with their dental, and they had plates, right? And they had to wear mouth guards, and they were told it was because they prevented concussion.
Ah, okay.
And yep. I always thought that was really funny.
yeah. It's a common misconception. I mean, and the list goes on. I mean, it goes with helmets. It goes with mouth guards. There are even... And here's the thing. You have good, well-meaning people with good intentions who have a good idea, or what they think is a good idea. And they'll take this little thing and they'll put it on top of the helmet, or they'll make this little headband and for soccer and say, oh, yeah, this reduces forces to the brain, et cetera, et cetera. And that's great. But are we being motivated by science, or are we being motivated by fear, or are we being motivated by money? You know what I'm saying?
Or so, magic.
Yeah, or magic. Yeah, whatever. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we have to have good science to back up any claims. So any product, whether it's a mouth guard, headband, helmet, whatever, that claims or implies concussion reduction or, brain protection, whatever it is, because they're creative. What they'll do is they won't come out and say it.
Right.
Because I think they know what the data says. But they'll name a product with the implication that people who don't understand will think, oh, well, this is gonna protect my brain. I won't get a concussion.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is, you have to meet that with skepticism and say, where's your data? And who's doing your study? Is this an independent study, or is this something that you've done personally? So you really have to, your BS meter has to be on for sure. So anyway, that's a little bit of a soapbox, but don't put your faith in any outside source yet to prevent any concussion. And that could change. I mean, there's a lot of research going on. I mean, at an astounding level. I mean, just in the past 5 to 10 years alone,
mm-hmm.
Concussion research has just skyrocketed. It's gone through the roof, which is a really good thing. So it'll be interesting to see at the end of 2016, where they release the next concussion paper, sort of the consensus statement, what that will say on different devices and things. So
I know it's always exciting, because I mean, it's sad too, because it's built on the backs of people that have been experiencing concussions in professional sports.
Yes,
all these studies are built on hockey players and football players and even soccer players, anyone that has head impact. And it's sad that their sacrifice is going to make athletes safer, hopefully, in the future.
Yes. Yeah, it's an unfortunate but true part of what's going on right now, for sure.
So. All right. Next question from Rhonda. She says, how long before effects of a concussion can be seen? Is it possible to have no initial symptoms but have weird things show up a week or two later?
Rhonda, awesome, awesome, awesome question. I love this question. The reason I love this question so much is because this helps us understand why we have to be so careful with head injuries. I know there's a lot of roller girls throughout Milwaukee and throughout the nation that are rolling their eyes right now because I just never shut up about concussions, okay?
Me either.
that's how I got my derby name, okay? My derby name is the Headhunter, okay?
Nice. So, I love it. That's perfect.
Yeah, isn't that fantastic? Yes, the answer is yes. You can have a delayed onset of symptoms. And the furthest I've personally seen it is 3 days.
Okay.
I've never seen it up to 1 to 2 weeks. Now, and this is consistent with the current literature. This could change in the future, but the current literature suggests that if you are having symptoms that are showing up a week or two later, if it's that far delayed, either one of two things is happening. Number one, you had another injury to the head that you just didn't quite consider.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Or there's some other issue that's going on. Could it be a hormonal issue? Could it be a vertigo issue? Could it be, you know, some other thing?
Sinus infection.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
You know?
And it depends on what symptoms are going on. Okay. So if you have a headache, do you just normally get headaches, or like you're saying, a sinus infection, or, you know, any number of things. So typically once you hit that, 7 to 10 day mark, you start looking in other directions. So
mm-hmm.
the furthest I've personally seen it is 3 days. Now the literature will say several hours. They don't lengthen it out to days. But I had one time I had a roller girl who came to me 3 days later and was like, I took a hard fall and I felt fine until today.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, you know, clinically I had to make a judgment call, and I said, well, I'm not gonna, you know, this is your safety we're talking about here, and this is your brain. We're gonna treat this as a concussion, even if it's not.
Mm-hmm.
So that being said, okay, so how does this, why should we be concerned about this? Because people can be concussed and not know it.
Exactly.
And when you go back into a game after a head injury, your risk for further concussion and further serious catastrophic injury goes up, okay? Not only that, but your risk for long-term issues and long-term recovery go up. Your sort of recovery process lengthens, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I want to touch base real quick on this. I talk about this in much more detail in the Roller Derby Concussion Project. That's on our YouTube channel. So please go and watch the videos on second impact syndrome and CTE, okay? But second impact syndrome is basically multiple, when you have multiple head impacts in a row, in a short span of time, the brain at some point, which kind of does have this sort of like bank account, like we were talking about, you know, like it has a limit to how much it can take.
Right.
So once the brain says, you know what, I've had enough, I'm done, it does this thing where it swells rapidly. It's almost like a, you know, like a car accident, traumatic brain injury.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you get this rapid onset of swelling, and it's completely debilitating. So from what I know, okay, and I could be wrong on this, but from what I've studied on this, there's two outcomes once that second impact syndrome happens. Number one is death.
Mm-hmm.
And number two is permanent physical and mental, cognitive, emotional impairment for life.
Yes.
If you want to find a really good documentary to watch on this, this one changed my whole perspective on concussions and head injury. Go to on YouTube or ESPN or wherever and search for their show E60 on
okay.
a guy named Preston Plevridis, P-R-E-S-T-O-N. His last name is Plevridis. That's P-L-E-V-R-E-T-E-S, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it tells his story of second impact syndrome. Now, he was a young football player, collegiate football player, who just got rocked, and it changed his life forever. Now, he's never the same. He'll never be the same. He was lucky to survive. So that's why, again, you have to be careful, because if you go back in there before your brain is ready and you continue to take hits and more hits and more hits, boom, eventually it says, I've had enough. That's it. And then you're either dead or you're impaired for life. So we don't ever want anybody to have to go through that. Now, typically that happens in people that are under 25 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So especially in junior derby and in kind of the young people that are coming up, 18 to 25 year olds, you have to be very careful with this. Not that it has never happened in someone above 25, but for some reason the developing brain is at a higher risk for this.
Right, and that's something as a teacher I knew. The developing brain of kids under 18, I didn't know it went up to 25. Which I guess, you know, once you hit 25, your brain calcifies, so it's a little tougher.
Right.
I'm kidding. But, you know, and I think it's true. I tend to see the concussion issues in younger players.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, somewhere along the line, you know, you have parents who have kind of come up with this idea that, oh, kids bounce back so quick. And the truth is that they actually take a little bit longer to heal mm-hmm. from head injuries. And they're actually more susceptible to head injuries than adults, because proportionally their heads are larger than their necks can support. So essentially you have like a little bobblehead doll running around.
Yeah, I used to call that the dandelion syndrome.
Yeah, right,
you know,
right,
you see kids riding their bikes and they have their helmets and their heads are just kind of swinging everywhere. Yep.
Yeah. So you have this huge mass and then it runs into stuff, and then you have this little tiny neck to support it. And of course the brain is going to slosh around inside the head. Mm-hmm. So anyway, you know, that being said, to answer the initial question, yes, delayed onset symptoms can happen. So that's why it's very, very important. If someone, here's my kind of rule of thumb. If somebody has a head impact large enough for the crowd to go, oh,
mm-hmm.
you probably need to take them out, okay? Mm-hmm. So that's why vigilance is very, very important. You have to be able to see the injury, because not everybody is going to understand that they're concussed. And by the way, if you get a hit to the head that produces any symptom, even if it's just a small headache mm-hmm. for a couple of seconds, that is a concussion. You need to be out right away. So, you know, that is what I would consider an ultra conservative point of view, but the literature is consistent with that. It's impossible to rule out a concussion if you have a hit that produces symptoms. Okay. So,
well, I know there's going to be a lot of skaters that are not going to like to hear that. So please say it again.
Yeah. So any force to the brain, either direct or indirect, that causes symptoms. So that means slight headache, a little ringing in the ears, a little dizziness, seeing stars, any symptom that wasn't present before the impact, that is considered a concussion. Okay, so you need to remove yourself from play right away, go see a medical provider, athletic trainer, physician, depending on where you're at in the world, it might be a physiotherapist or an athletic therapist or something like that. Best person to see in America is either an athletic trainer or a physician, ideally a physician that's either board certified or experienced in sports medicine. That's that.
It's good to know, though. That's good information, because, you know, I've been saying it for a really long time. You know, I had a friend that died of a traumatic brain injury, not due to roller derby, but following his decline after the injury was heartbreaking. And I don't want to ever see that happen to anybody in our sport because of our sport.
And that's why, that's why I'm so passionate about this subject and why people get so irritated with me, because I took an inner vow when I watched that video that I told you about.
Mm-hmm. And one of our listeners found it and posted it on my post. So okay. I'll be able to update everybody with that.
Yeah. It's a heart-wrenching story, but I took a vow right then and there. And I said, not on my watch. This is, if there's anything that I can do about it, this will not happen. And is that, you know, somewhat being motivated by fear? Yeah. Okay. But I think there's a healthy fear, a healthy respect for that injury that says, wow, this is dangerous. You know, and a mentor of mine once told me, Ryan, you know, athletic trainers can have their strengths and their weaknesses, but if it's something that's going to permanently impair somebody for life or kill them, you'd better know exactly what you're doing.
Exactly.
And I'll never forget that. And so, yeah, that's why I love this subject. I have a love-hate relationship with concussions.
Well, of course.
I love it. Yeah. I hate what it does to people, you know?
Of course. Well, we'll probably be getting back to that, because I know there are more questions about it on here.
Yeah, great.
But one of the questions, Jessica Andrews asked, review which helmets are best ranked. I think you've talked about that, so we're going to pass on that one. But she also says, what are ideal policies for leagues regarding safety equipment at practice, games, and outside of league? Where does a player draw the line between pushing boundaries and pushing too much?
Yeah, Jessica, amazing question. Thank you so much for shooting it our way. So policies and league procedures, you know, up until I saw your question, I didn't realize that it differed throughout different leagues. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. when I was at Bruce City, it was like, you had skates on, you had all your equipment on.
Yeah, that's the way we are too. Even if you're in a parade, okay. You have to, everything.
Yes. Yep, 100%. Yep. So I think that's a great policy. It's number one, helps reduce the risk for everybody's injury. Number two, reduces the risk for liability for the club. It's just safer. I think it's common sense. If you're on skates, you got to be wearing your wrist guards, your helmet, your knee pads, your mouth guard, et cetera, et cetera. You know, when you're outside of the league, you're your own person. You know, if I could recommend it, absolutely, I would recommend full equipment because it just makes sense. But you know, you're not really in the confines of the league anymore. So that I'll leave that up to you. Where does a player draw the line between pushing boundaries and pushing too much? So, you know, in the context of injury itself, do you think? Or are we talking head injuries particular?
I think it's all, you know, you feel... I always say that to newer skaters, you got to know the difference between being uncomfortable and being in pain.
Yes.
And I think that's the question. And I think that's a question that you have to reevaluate as you play more and more.
Yes.
You know, what is uncomfortable? What is pain?
Yeah. And this is something that's going to be very difficult for new players.
Mm-hmm.
This the terrible and wonderful thing about roller derby is that anybody can join. And a lot of skaters that I saw come through, it was their first sport ever.
Exactly.
You know? Which is great. It's awesome. I love that role. That's one of the things that I love most about roller derby is it's so inclusive that anybody can play it. But you also have a whole bunch of people who, and I don't mean this in any negative way, but you just don't know what you're getting into. You
mm-hmm.
know what I'm saying? So they maybe have never had an injury before.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't understand how to differentiate between, wow, I just got a good workout and I'm kind of sore.
Right.
Or, wow, this hurts. You know what I mean?
Yeah, now so, I can't move. Like, literally,
yes,
this yes. doesn't move right anymore.
Yeah. That's a process... unfortunately, that only comes with experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so as you train, as you get better, as you understand what that feels like, you'll learn to know the difference. It doesn't take very long to know when something's seriously wrong, right? So to answer the question directly, here's my rule of thumb, okay? And this is just generally speaking. If you have a doubt in your mind, go see somebody. Just get it checked out to be safe. But
mm-hmm.
in general, what I tell skaters, especially when they're dealing with like kind of gray area injuries, oh, my knee hurts a little bit, and maybe that got some tendonitis or something like that. My rule of thumb is that if it's causing you to compensate in your skating, you know,
mm-hmm.
sort of do like a limp thing or change your technique in some way because you're trying to get away from pain,
mm-hmm.
that's when it becomes a safety issue to not only yourself, but everybody around you.
Right.
So that's where I kind of draw the line and say, well, and pain is subjective to everybody. So a 2 out of 10 for someone may be so different than, you know, a 5 out of 10, for example. You know, they might be perceived as different numbers, but they might even be kind of the same injury. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. So, it's, you know, my hangnail might be your agony.
Yeah, right.
You
exactly.
know?
Yep. Yeah, that's a much better way to say it. Thank you.
Well, I've been doing this, you know, dealing with the newbies asking this question for a long time. So I tell them they have to listen to their bodies, but sometimes they don't know what their bodies are saying.
The best set of advice that I can give you is get somebody involved in your club, either an athletic trainer, physician, physical therapist, even a medic would be fine. Although, you know, medics, I can say this because I was an EMT, okay? Medics are not trained necessarily in return to play decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're looking for someone who wants to make a decision on whether or not you can go back to playing, athletic trainer is your route to go. Physician is your route to go. So it's really, really valuable. I can't tell you how important it is to have somebody to make those decisions for you so you don't have to be the blind leading the blind. You know what I'm saying?
Well, exactly. And it's really hard to talk to physicians that don't understand the sport. So it's really amazing when they do. Like, I had broken my hand a couple of years ago, and my orthopedic guy, you know, I used to call him my hand guy. But my hand guy knew what I was doing. He understood the sport because they were sponsors of ours. So he had seen several roller girls and, you know, due to small little injuries to their fingers and stuff like that. He knew what I was doing. He didn't tell me not to skate. You know, the first thing out of his mouth was, don't skate, you know, which I was expecting. And I think a lot of people that play roller derby expect that. You know, they expect to be told by their physician, oh, you better not be doing that anymore, you know.
Yep.
So it's good to have someone that understands the sport or at least understands sport in general.
Yes, and that's particularly why I like physicians who are board certified in sports medicine. And a lot of times, if you get a good orthopedic surgeon too, like the guy that I worked with in Milwaukee is absolutely fantastic. I would recommend anybody to go see him because he knows sports.
Well, you can say his name on the air. It's cool. You can give him a plug.
Eric Pfeifel, Orthopedic Institute of Wisconsin. Shout out to you, man. Good to work with you. So what was I saying? So if you have somebody that understands sports and understands that you can modify your activities now, okay, somebody's got a broken hand. No, you're not going back in there. There's no reason to play with a broken hand, right? But after you've started doing your rehab or your surgery or whatever it is, there are reasonable things that you can start doing where you don't have to completely stop altogether. And so, you know, again, so you're not playing the guessing game. You know, next year, guys, priority number one has to be find somebody who's willing to invest in your club.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Do you have any suggestions on how to do that? Because I know a lot of leagues and a lot of clubs would love to know what works to pull someone in like that.
Yeah. Honestly, okay, there's a couple of ways that are very effective. Number one, you could pay them.
Exactly. Okay. Money always works.
Yep. That tends to get a little bit expensive, okay? Typically, especially when you're talking about sports medicine specialty services, physicians are not cheap, okay?
Right.
A lot of times what works very nicely, and I don't know the details, okay, of my sports medicine contract or the physician sports medicine contract or anything like that or people that I've worked with, I was kind of out of that loop, okay? But it looks something like this. Your provider comes in and donates time and services. And in return, you give them certain maybe sponsorship package, okay? Maybe that includes some social media posts. Maybe that includes some signage on the wall at the bouts. Maybe it includes an announcement at halftime, or maybe it includes the jammer line or the, you know, power jam thanks to, you know, XYZ sports medicine, et cetera, you know. And also in turn, the best way to give back to them if they're a sponsor is to send them patients. Absolutely the best way. Now, in America, okay, I don't know about outside the US, but in America, technically, you know, it's like illegal for you to say you have to go here, right? You can't do that. But what you can do is you can give that person an opportunity to invest in the club and sort of sell their services, for lack of a better term. So, you know, if you have a doc or an athletic trainer that goes in and donates some time, you know, and for example, in return, they have one person that, you know, not that I ever wish this on anybody, but breaks their leg and gets a surgery, for example, right? That probably pays for itself, you know? So there are a lot of ways that you can do it, but that kind of gives you a real general idea. Some docs are real excited to do that. Some athletic trainers are real excited to do that. Others are not. And so you have to have grace when you're going into those situations like that, because they might not be educated. They don't know what roller derby is. But, you know, you might start by giving them some tickets and say, hey, come to our bout and see if this is something you want to be a part of, you know? So roller derby is a very attractive thing. It's a very cool phenomenon. And I think a lot of providers would be very foolish to not be a part of it, you know?
Well, you need to go out and sell it for us.
Well,
you've got the gift of gab.
One of our major goals is, you know, we're very small right now, but we want to establish a global network of preferred providers that are excited about roller derby. We want to help teams get hooked up with people in their area so that it doesn't rely on them and it doesn't rely on us. I mean, you know, we can't save the world, right?
Right.
I mean, although that's in some ways kind of what we're trying to do, right?
Exactly.
We're trying to make a global change, which is awesome. But it starts slowly and intentionally with small steps here and there. So, you know, if you guys are interested in reaching out to us, that's absolutely a part of our vision and our mission. So.
Great. All right, let's drop down to the next question on avoiding neck injuries. And I think this is interesting because we had a boxing coach come in and help us with our neck injuries because we were getting girls with a lot of them.
Okay.
So I spend a lot of time falling at practice and I frequently whip my neck when I go down. So I'm wondering a couple of things. One, is my neck getting stronger, more resilient over time, or am I slowly doing severe damage? And two, what can I do to strengthen my neck, i.e. taping, exercises, PT?
Okay, great questions. Do we have a name on this one or not?
I do not know where it went. I can't find it. So I'm sorry,
anonymous.
And I apologize to the listener that sent this one in.
That's all right. Thanks, anonymous question asker. So for number one, is your neck getting stronger, more resilient over time? Are you doing damage? Probably a little bit of both, to be very honest with you. There's an adaptation that certainly happens when you stress the muscle. The muscle, once it stresses, knows one thing, and that's to grow stronger, grow more muscle, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you're consistently snapping your head back, I'd be concerned with two things, actually. Number one, neck pain and neck injury, mm-hmm. and number two, concussions, okay? Mm-hmm. Because your neck is what holds your head on and keeps things in place. So the answer I would say is yes to both. Now, to piggyback off that and kind of answer the second question, strengthening your neck is actually pretty simple. And I'm actually, I have it in my plan to put up a concussion exercise video or a neck strengthening exercise video. So that's more to come. But doing things like shoulder shrugs, isometric exercises, where basically what that means is you're challenging the strength of your neck by pushing on either side of your head, front, back, side to side, rotating, etc. You're trying to push against it, but you're resisting in a way that your neck is not moving. Does that make sense? So
yes,
if I push on the right side of my head, I'm just trying to hold it still and contract the muscles. You know what I'm saying?
Can you, right.
Can you see me doing that through the microphone?
And that's what the boxing coach was basically showing us, yes. how to do this stuff. And he said it's really important in boxing because, you know, boxing has a concussion situation as well. And to help out, he said it's not going to stop any. It's not going to necessarily protect you from concussion, but it can help. Your neck strength can help keep your head in place.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's the theory. So there's one study that was published. Now, I don't know if a more recent study has been published yet, but I know of one where their conclusion was for every 1 pound in neck strength that you gain, you have a decreased risk of concussion by 5%.
Oh, that's pretty amazing. I did not know that.
Yeah, so I can get you the citation if you want. I don't know it off the top of my head, but that's one study. That's a significant finding, I would say for sure. But I think more needs to be done to kind of study the validity of that claim and is that true across larger populations and things like that. So, but yes, neck strengthening is where it's apt for concussion prevention for sure.
I have a weird off topic of this question.
Yep.
The boxing coach is a friend of mine, but he works with males and females, and I never asked him this, but I'm going to ask you because you have the more medical background to this. Do you see women having more problems with concussions or men? Or is there a difference?
I could be wrong on this, but I'm fairly sure. I just recently read an article where it said, especially in the youth, that it's more prevalent in women than it is with men. Now, in roller derby, just personally, I dealt with more women.
Right.
Continue to deal
right.
with more women because it's a female-dominated sport at this point. From what I understand, or at least the theory is, this could be completely off base, but the theory is that in general, men's necks are a little bit larger, a little bit stronger. They can handle more blows. Than their female counterparts. So it seems to make sense that it would be more prevalent in women than men, but I would have to check my citations on that to be sure.
Well, I just heard something on the news, and God, you know the news. They latch on to like the newest whatever. They don't necessarily read all the articles, but I heard that young female sports players tend to have more concussions and more issues with concussions.
Yes, yeah, I would say that's consistent with what I've seen as well.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Interesting. Yep. All right. Next question is from David Lowry. Somebody you know?
Yes, that's my uncle.
Okay. When is it going to be the time that we quit ignoring CTE? And can you explain what CTE is for the listeners that maybe don't know?
Yeah. Yeah. So CTE stands for chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Okay. Chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And what that is basically, let me see if I can put this in somewhat of easy terms to understand. Imagine arthritis for the brain. Now that's a very simplistic way of explaining it. Okay. But basically you have multiple, either concussive or subconcussive forces to the brain over time, over a long career. And it results in the buildup of what's called a tau protein, TAU. Mm-hmm. And what that does is it basically creates functional problems for you later on in life. So those things include depression, anxiety, issues with speech and memory, issues with spending habits and impulsivity, rage problems. I mean, it's no joke. It's very serious stuff. It's real prevalent in a lot of the NFL players that have been along for a while. And,
right.
you know, some of these guys that you've seen and, you know, we'll go here, but, you know, just this is a little bit of a more of a mature content is that they kill themselves. They shoot themselves in the chest and then they donate their brain to science because
right.
they know something's not quite right. So CTE can be a very, very ugly thing. It's a very real thing. It's something that has really just popped up over the past 5 to 10 years. And the controversy that Dave is talking about is that things allegedly have been kind of swept under the rug by the powers that be, okay, in those organizations of professional sports. Okay. And so that's when he's saying, when are we going to, as a society, start recognizing this? Well, I think it's getting much better. If you are interested in CTE, I follow the Concussion Legacy Foundation, and
mm-hmm.
that's headed up by Chris Nowinski. He was a former WWE wrestler. Robert Cantu, he's a physician that heads up that program as well. And then Ann McKee, she does a great amount of research and I believe receives the brain, studies them, and then reports the findings to the families. So it's a very, very intense subject. It's coming up all over again and again, and people are retiring from sports early because of fears of it. And so I don't know if that quite answers the question or not. But
well, I think it does, and I think it's something that we need to look at. You know, we were talking off mic for, you know, off the show for a bit last week, and you were saying, what was the average career of a roller derby player?
You know, I don't have any quite statistics on that. That's a great question. I don't quite remember that.
Okay, we were talking about it because I'm retiring, and this is my eighth year.
Okay.
And
okay.
we were talking about there are quite a few people out there that have been playing 10 or 11 years.
Yeah.
You
mm-hmm.
know,
yep.
without necessarily knowing that they could be, you know, doing some kind of damage to themselves.
Yeah.
Might we see this with people in
yeah.
our
is
sport?
Is it plausible? Is it plausible? Absolutely, it's plausible. The problem is, even research in the most publicized arenas is in its very infant stages. It's brand new. I want to say the amount of brains that they've studied altogether is nearing 100.
Mm-hmm.
They may have broken 100, but that just kind of gives you an idea of how many things they've been able to produce over the past few years. And so as it gets publicized more, as it gains more traction, we're going to find more about it. Currently, it's not able to be diagnosed in someone that's living. We understand the symptoms. We understand the presentation. But it's very different than, say, like a dementia or an Alzheimer's. I mean, it's similar, but the structure of the brain looks a little bit different in the disease presentation. And so it's something very specific that is so far as we can tell directly correlated with head trauma over time. And so they don't know how many hits a brain can take before you start to develop CTE. In some of the younger guys, I want to say they found CTE in a kid that was 18, and I believe he shot himself as well. He was a high school football player, 18-year-old kid. I don't know how long he was playing, but you know, it remains to be seen. Can one concussion produce CTE? We don't know. What the greater concern is multiple sort of subconcussive forces over time, meaning, you know, you just kind of get a little smack to the helmet and, you know, you don't get any concussive symptoms, but it's still a force to your brain. The
right.
brain still moves around inside the skull, right? Kind of like we talked about with the egg. But so we have way more questions than we do have answers on this, but the first step is recognizing it for what it is and respecting it and
mm-hmm.
studying it more. So.
I think that's a great answer, and it's a little scary, but hopefully nobody is going to have to deal with CTE in the future.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I've played contact sports since I was seventh grade, and I've been in and out of them even after that in college and after college, and somewhat now I do Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which is kind of a contact sport.
Right.
But,
right.
you know, I catch knees to the head and things like that occasionally. And so, yeah, it's very much a personal worry for me. And I believe usually the onset is somewhere around, you know, late 30s or early 40s, you know, so I'm approaching that.
Except for those of us that started derby at 39.
Yeah, right. You know, and from what I understand, the correlations or what they're suggesting is that the longer exposure you have or from an earlier age, the higher your risk becomes. So the kids that are starting to play football at 7 years old and, you know, 6 years old, full contact football, all the way through middle school, high school, college, the pros. My goodness, that's a lot of blows to the head.
Yeah, it really
so
is.
What they're suggesting with not only concussion prevention, but with CTE prevention, of course, we want to do neck strengthening, but what they're saying is we need to drop the hit count, okay? Or sort of the amount of times that you get hit in the head, okay? So you can modify your practices, do no contact practices or light contact practices, that's fine. But again, it seems to make sense that the less times you get hit in the head, the better your brain is off.
All right, so I'm going to kind of spring this one on you because I've been thinking about this for a really long time. What can we do to make our sport safer for this kind of thing? Because I feel like we're taking it in the other direction, where we tend to get more hits to the head or deceleration issues, or, you know, different people are going different speeds on the track and someone slams into a wall. I feel like the way we've played now is causing more of these issues.
Mm-hmm. And you're talking specifically with head injuries?
Yes.
Yeah. I think, to be very honest with you, I think it's gotten better, but I think it's a cultural issue. Meaning, and it kind of goes back to that terrible and wonderful thing about roller derby, right?
Mm-hmm.
People may or may not truly understand how to train for this sport. People may or may not truly understand how to eat like an athlete, how to train like an athlete. And so I think that's what it comes down to. Number one, understanding your limitations, understanding how to train. I think getting roller girls to eat better and stop smoking helps their overall athleticism. I know we laugh, right? But, you know, I've seen it. I've seen it all over.
Well, I think it's funny because for a while, Caroline, I got to tell you, I never smoked when I was playing derby or anything. But, you know, for a long time, 2009, almost all our All-Stars did. And then suddenly they just stopped. Like, they were like, nope, we're athletes. We're not doing this anymore. And I always encourage people, but I still see people smoking, and I'm just like, how do you survive?
Right,
you
know? Right.
How do you survive in this sport and smoke?
Yes. Now, what does that have to do with head injury? I think it's more of an indirect thing, okay? What I'm speaking to is the culture. We need, if we're going to act as though this is a sport, because it is, right, we need to sort of adopt an athlete mentality. And so along with that goes all those good things that I just talked about. Now, as far as training and conditioning goes, that can go a long way if you do it properly for head injury prevention and just overall injury prevention. So as a part of your sponsorship package or your paid whatever you do for services for people, have somebody come in and do a training program for you. Not just a couple of days a week or whatever, but have them do a year-long periodized training cycle for you so you understand how do we train appropriately. Then we also talk about what days do we go contact, what days do we go non-contact. I suggested, when I would suggest this to roller girls, not just in Milwaukee but in some of the other places as well, you know, that you train differently.
Mm-hmm.
Some were pretty good about it, others they look at me like I'm trying to chop their arm off. You're
right.
Like, you know, and you have some girls that like are bouting on Saturday, and not only if they're bouting on Saturday, then they're practicing full go on Friday and on Sunday. You know what I mean? So it's like you have all this, just this mentality of go, 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 go. And it does a couple of things. Number one, it increases your risk for injury.
Right.
If you cut out 25% of your practices that are contact, you'll probably have a close to a 25% reduction in injury. Now, also they will, I lost it.
Well, to be fair, though, I will say this. We do a non-contact kind of practice. We have non-contact practices that are available and do. But we still get people hurt on those practices. They hurt themselves by doing footwork.
Yep. Understood. Yeah. And sometimes you can't prevent it. The other thing I was going to touch on was burnout. I can't tell you how many times every year I heard, I just need a break from derby. And it's because they don't allow themselves enough rest. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's really hard to condense into an hour-long show, how much rest you need. But, you know, if you have someone that's a strength and conditioning specialist that can come out and say, hey, here's what you're going to do for your training programs, not only off-skates training, but on-skates training as well, that you might notice a big difference in your injury rates. So,
love it. All right, next question is from Heather Blazer. As we all know, our ankles are super vulnerable. I know some good stretches and strengthening, but I'm always looking for more. If I never see an ankle break again, I would be a happy girl. And we just recently had one of our jammers, Magic, broke her ankle in three places. Yeah. Tib fib. And, you know, our hearts go out to her because it really sucks. But what can we do to prevent it, or at least to help prevent it?
Yeah, so... in general with this, it's about reducing your risk, okay? And I'll preface what I'm about to say with the fact that you can do all these things and you can still break your ankle, because the truth is the pack is a very, very unpredictable place to be. And I've found personally that that's where most ankle fractures happen. Kind of the freak accidents where, it just all of a sudden pops up and there's nothing that you can do about it. But in general, what you want to do for ankle work or ankle injury prevention is concentrate on mobility. Okay. So things like calf stretches, forward ankle stretches, things like that. And then also stability of the ankle. So balance exercises are huge. Foot strength is absolutely huge. Hip strength actually comes into play as well, because it kind of it affects the position of your knee, which travels down the chain and affects the position of your foot. So that's number one. Doing kind of some prehab exercise and things like that. I'm sure there's some good sources on YouTube. If you guys want, I'll be happy to do a video on that as well. The other is, like we talked about, better fitness. If you're more fit in general, you're gonna have a lower risk for injury. Now again, everybody's gonna go out there and say, well, I'm the fittest person on my team and I broke this and this. Well, okay, there's outliers, but in general, right, if you're a better athlete, a more fit athlete, you're going to have a lower risk for injury. The last thing that I say that has to do with ankle injuries, and this is more, a little bit more of a mystical thing, kind of a subjective thing, and it's kind of your athletic prowess or your athletic awareness, right? Is your head on a swivel? Are you watching what you're doing when you go in the pack? And by the way, when fatigue sets in towards the end of the bout, that starts to go down, right? So are you focused? Are you in the game? Or are you just kind of willy-nilly thinking about daisies, you know? And then the last thing I say is experience helps, okay? So a lot of times you just have to get that experience of what it's like to know where to go. Now, I preface that with, or kind of piggyback on that by saying, I've never played roller derby personally. I've got the sports med side, so I don't know what it's like to skate up onto a pack, okay? But what I've noticed is that, in general, experience helps with those ankle fractures. So, you know, keep that in mind. And again, you can do all that stuff and give your best effort, and still sometimes those freak accidents happen. So
I know sometimes you can't prevent the injury at all, but it, you know, I like to increase my odds of being safe and healthy at the end of a game.
100%.
And like, so, I always point out, you know, people always worry about the games, but I said most injuries don't happen in games. They happen in practice, because that's where you are most of the time.
Yes.
So be more aware of the practices, you know, try not to let that fatigue get to you during the practice. We have 4-hour practices on Sunday. That is a real push for some people, you know. You have to build to it.
And you'll be better suited for that if you're not just using derby as your exercise.
Exactly.
So if you're actually training outside of derby, doing off skates training, that will go easier for you.
And so, I always try to tell people that you can't let derby get you in shape. You have to get into shape to play derby.
Right.
You know, and I don't mean shape like I want to fit into my bathing suit. I mean, physical shape to play derby. And it's not the thing that's going to get you there.
And it's hard. I mean, you know, and again, this goes back to the awesomeness of derby. You know, we had all sorts of people. You have a CPA, you have a lawyer, a doctor, you have a full-time mom, whatever it is. And people don't always have the time, and derby is their outlet. So, you know, that's a hard line to balance, because you don't want to just railroad people into like, oh, you got to train, you know. But at the same time, the truth is, the more athleticism you have, the better off you're going to be as far as injuries go. So, you know, you have to find that balance, and that's a hard thing to do sometimes.
It really is. It is for people that have time for it too.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so here's my thing. We are running out of time for all the questions that we have. So I'm wondering if you could come back like maybe next month.
Are you kidding? I'd love to. This is awesome.
Excellent. So I'm going to end just with this last question. This is it's something that happened to one of my teammates. And Ellen Ulrich writes, and she says, how the heck does somebody have a broken jaw and not realize it? We had a teammate that has a broken jaw and did not know it. And she found out because she has a fractured splinter growing into her mouth from the jaw. And it definitely happened during one of the games, but she was unaware of it. How common is that? Do you see players that don't know that they're that hurt?
How long did she notice after, how long did it take her to understand that something was wrong?
Well, I guess it just happened recently that she had to go to the doctors and she has an infection because there's some sort of abscess now because of the break.
No. Yep. Okay, so long enough. Yeah.
Yes, it's been a while.
She woke up the next morning and all of a sudden her jaw was sore.
No.
Wow, that's a fantastic question. And I'm not entirely sure how to answer it other than, you know, pain is different for different people.
Mm-hmm.
For some ladies, childbirth is very easy. For most, it's not.
Right.
You know, but you know, everybody processes pain differently. And I'll tell you one thing. I've worked in sports medicine for almost about 10 years here, and the toughest people in the world are women,
mm-hmm.
and people from the World War II era. I don't know what it is, guys or gals. The people that are from kind of that 40s, 50s era are just tough as nails. And I'll tell you what, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've had a roller girl come up to me and be like, hey, can you check out my hand? And there is a definite fracture in there,
yeah.
You know? So they're just, women are tough. Women are very tough. And I think they just process pain a little bit differently than most people, especially if they're a roller girl and they're getting smashed around every day, you know? So yeah, toughness, I think is a good answer, at least a somewhat reasonable answer for that. So
yeah, I think it's true. And I honestly, when those endorphins are going, you don't feel it.
Yes. Yes.
You know, when I broke my hand, I was like,
yep.
I'm pretty sure that's not good, but I kept jamming anyway, you know?
Yeah, of course you did. Yeah.
Right. And then at halftime I went over and talked to the medic and they took my, you know, it was one of those slip on wrist guards. So they had to take it off and it was a boxer's break. So it was right on the, under the pinky and it really hurt. And they're like, yeah, that's broken. And I'm like, can you just put it back on and I'll go back and finish the game? They're like, no.
Of course. Yep, that's what it, tape it up, please. Just tape it up. I'm going back in.
Yeah, I'm going back in, exactly. And
yeah, no, that's perfect. That's a typical response. That's absolutely fantastic.
Well, yeah, it's not the smart response, but it's definitely the response I had at the time.
Agreed.
All right, well, you've wasted another hour listening to Q's Tips, although I think this has been a fantastically informational hour, and I really appreciate you coming on, and we definitely need to have you back next month, Ryan.
Yeah, thanks, Q.
All right, so our sponsors tonight are houseofskate.net, and if you use the code ELECTRA, all capitals, ELEKTRA, you will get 10% off your orders, and I know I need to get stuff myself, so I'm excited that there's a 10% off. And this episode is brought to you by Krispy Kreme and Man Candy from Kinston's Roller Derby League, the Ring City Roller Girls. Ring City will be hosting their fourth annual Masquerade Brawl Invitational on October 29th at Galaxy of Sports. This year's Masquerade Brawl will be the Game of Thrones themed and will feature mini bouts for rookie, intermediate, and experienced skaters open to men and women. Check out the Ring City Roller Girl Facebook page for events or just to give them a like. Ring City practices at Galaxy of Sports in Kinston, North Carolina, Mondays and Wednesday nights from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Contact them for their open practices if you'd like to join in on the fun. Ring City Roller Girls, bringing roller derby to Eastern North Carolina since 2006. And Ryan, do you have anything you want to add about your Facebook page or anything?
Yeah, just find us on Facebook, Derby Injury Prevention Network, and it's the same tagline for YouTube. Check out our YouTube channel, subscribe, like, comment. That's kind of the easiest way to get in touch with us. If you have a direct question, we're always looking for new ideas for videos and putting out good information there. So, yeah, thank you again so much for your time tonight, you guys, and Q for having me on. It's been a very pleasant experience. Thanks.
Excellent.
Again.
Well, we'll be talking to you later.
All right. Thank you
so much. Thanks for listening. And tune in next week when we have Junior Roller Derby discussion going on. All right. Bye-bye.